It's my pleasure to introduce Professor Gary Anderson, one of the world's leading Old Testament scholars. He serves as the Hesburgh Professor of Catholic Theology at the University of Notre Dame. He's been a Henry Luce Fellow, fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, a Starr Fellow in Jewish Studies at Harvard University, and the Strauss-Tikva Fellow at the Law School at New York University. Currently, Professor Anderson is the president of the Catholic Biblical Association and will be presenting his presidential address at Providence College this summer. His area of specialty is the Old Testament and early Judaism and the reception of the Bible in the rabbis and the church fathers. One of the strong points of his research is the use of the Syriac fathers in particular, and he's also conversant with modern Israeli scholarship and encourages his students to read modern Hebrew. His first book was Sacrifices and Offerings in Ancient Israel, 1987. And his most recent books are Sin, A History, 2010, and Charity, 2013. The subtitle here, The Place of the Poor in the Biblical Tradition. Looking at all of Professor Anderson's works, I think we could say that God is really at the heart of his work. What separates us from God, namely sin, personal and original, and what joins us to God, namely sacrifice, law, covenant, grace, purgatory, and charity. Professor Anderson's been teaching so many future Dominicans at Notre Dame, I think we're going to have to put him on the payroll if he keeps going, but a lot of his former students are here today, and his son, Matthew Tobias, his youngest son, is now a member of the Dominican province of St. Albert the Great in formation, studying for the priesthood. We're delighted that Professor Anderson could be with us this weekend. His paper is entitled, God as Holy Other, Why It Can Be Dangerous to Draw Too Close to God.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. I have a colleague at the University of Notre Dame who works in St. Thomas Aquinas, and when he saw the book Sin, A History come out, he remarked in the hallway that I was much too young to write my autobiography. So there you have it. I wrote the charity book to see if I could atone for my sins. I'm delighted to be here. The title that was given for the title of my talk is certainly accurate as a descriptor. I slightly renamed it as I prepared this handout and the manuscript of the talk itself to a verse from Leviticus that's going to be central to what I want to speak to today. Those near to me, or through those near to me, I show myself holy, and perhaps just in order to give a kind of brief conspectus before I begin, it might be useful just to see where the talk is heading, and that is text number 8 on your handout, which is at the bottom of page 2. An extremely important moment in the Old Testament, certainly in the Old Testament simply considered on its own, we could say, I think one could very well argue, and people have, that it's the climax of the Torah itself, the appearance, the theophany of God once the tabernacle has been built. Verse 24, the very last verse of chapter 9 in Leviticus, fire came out from the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. Also a very important verse, I might argue, for Christian readers of the Bible as well. This verse, I think, refers back to the promised appearance of God in the tabernacle that's announced at the end of Exodus 29, a text that appears quite prominently in the New Testament, specifically the prologue to the Gospel of John, when John says that the Word became flesh to dwell among us. The Greek word for dwell, I'm sure as many of you know, skenoo in Greek, means literally to tent or tabernacle. And that verse in John's prologue is clearly has Exodus 29 in view and this text from Leviticus chapter 9. What I want to do this afternoon is speak to the moment of this theophany and the events that lead up to it, but then what happens in the immediately subsequent verse. An equally important verse in here, but something often of an embarrassment to modern readers. And now Aaron's sons, and I'll adopt here the Hebrew pronunciation of their names, Nadav and Abihu, each took his censer, put fire in it, laid incense on it, and offered alien fire. It's not quite clear how best to translate that, but we'll work with alien fire for now. Before the Lord, such as he had not commanded them, and fire came out from the presence of the Lord, presumably the same fire from the end of chapter 9, and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. And then we get my new title for my paper then from the subsequent verse. Moses said to Aaron, this is what the Lord meant when he said, through those who are near to me, I will show myself holy. Okay, so that's where we're going. We're going to try to understand this moment, the significance in Scripture of God's establishment of his holiness through the incineration of Nadav and Abihu. Okay, so there we go. Hopefully you won't wish for the same of me in the course of this talk. Okay, I want to address today the concept of God's holiness within the framework of God's choice to dwell among the Israelites in a tabernacle. One assumption that has to be made here is that God, in the mind of our biblical authors, really takes up residence in this tent. To quote Flannery O'Connor, as she once remarked when someone said that the Eucharist was a fine symbol, she said, if it's the symbol, just a symbol, then the hell with it. I think one has to have the similar kind of sensibility in reading the stories of the establishment of the tabernacle in the wilderness in the book of Exodus. The only way, I think, to appreciate the detail that our biblical writers are going to shower on this establishment is to recognize in the strong sense of the word the way in which God truly indwells this building. And as a result of that, it's not surprising that Michael Wishegrod, contemporary Jewish philosopher of religion, in his essay on the notion of the incarnation in the Jewish tradition, has argued, quote, God has undertaken to enter the world and to dwell in a place, end of quote. Here he's taking issue with Maimonides' supposition that God is wholly spiritual, and Wishegrod is trying to argue that there is a place within Judaism, a necessary place for construing God as tying his being to a material artifact, here, of course, the temple. This does not mean, however, that God's habitation is under restriction, for there's no place in the universe where God is not. But this truth about God's omnipresence, Wishegrod hastens to add, quote, must be combined with the insistence that God also has an address. There is a place where he dwells, and that place is Jerusalem. He dwells in number 1 Har Habayit Street, or to translate it into English, number 1 Temple Mount Street. Lest one think such a construal reflects pre-modern sensibilities alone, Wishegrod goes on to say, quote, many Jews report that they have a sense of the indwelling of God when they stand before the Western Wall. There are all kinds of stories about extremely assimilated secular Jews arriving in Jerusalem, showing up at the Western Wall and being overcome by a deep emotional experience. The tradition is that the divine presence will never leave the Western Wall. That is the one place in the world where God, in some special sense, is present. But let's turn our attention now to a second point, that of God's indwelling of the tabernacle. By this I mean the identification of his being, in some sense, with the architectural elements of the tabernacle. Most of us, of course, are aware of the strong and iconic tendency in the Bible, perhaps best reflected in the book of Deuteronomy, and to take simply one example, a verse from chapter 4, then the Lord spoke to you out of the fire, you heard the sound of words, but saw no form. There was only a voice. End of quote. Yet this strong and iconic bias should not blind us to what I wish to call the divine quality of the ark, and indeed of most of the furniture found within the tabernacle. The divine character of this furniture is best illustrated in Numbers 4, the first text on your handout, a text in which Moses is warning the sons of Aaron to take special care when they dismantle the tabernacle, lest any of the attending Levites, who are not priests, but rather assistants to the priests, lest these assistants catch even the briefest glimpse of the furniture within. For should such an inadvertent viewing take place, Moses warns, these Levitical servants would be in danger of immediate death. So our text, the Levites must not come near so as to see the appurtenances, that is, the furniture of the tabernacle, while Aaron and his sons disassemble them, lest they die. Clearly, our text is to be set side by side other texts in the Bible where the vision of God himself is thought to be death-threatening. The only way, I think, to understand Numbers 4 is to presume that for at least the priestly writer, the furniture of the tabernacle has absorbed enough of the divine essence to constitute a real danger to the living. Well, how are we to square Numbers 4 then with Deuteronomy? Well, what I would want to contend is that the Bible bequeaths to us a dialectical truth. The ark should not be confused with the very being of God, for biblical religion will brook no making of images. But neither is the ark a mere symbol of his presence. When God indwells the tabernacle, the entire area within it is radically transformed such that the ark somehow assumes an aspect, perhaps participates in the being of the God who dwells therein. Well, so far, I hope I have established 2 points. First of all, God has an address in the Old Testament, and 2, he's infused the furniture of the tabernacle with something of his divine essence. But this deeply, what I would want to call, incarnational quality has a particular danger. Individuals will be tempted to co-opt the ark to their own political and/or religious advantage, and so perhaps compromise the freedom of God. We can see this very danger enacted in what biblical scholars are wont to call the ark narrative in the books of Samuel. The narrative opens up with Israel suffering a terrible defeat at the hands of the Philistines and immediately turning to the ark in order to launch what they hope will be a second, more successful offensive. They will be defeated for a second time, but now the results are going to be catastrophic. The ark will be captured and fall into pagan hands. And let's take a look at text 3 on your handout. In those days, the Philistines mustered war against Israel, and when the battle was joined, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men in the field of battle. When the troops came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord put us to rout today before the Philistines?" Now, I probably should have done this on the text I handed out, but it would be useful if you're taking notes, perhaps, to put a parenthesis here with 3 dots, because something should take place, as we're going to see in a moment, between the question mark and the capital L. But nothing does take place, and that's precisely the problem. Why has the Lord put us to rout today before the Philistines? That's the question, and as it were, the next sentence constitutes the answer, a wrong answer, as we're going to see in a moment. Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh so that he may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies. When the Philistines learned that the Ark had come to the camp, they were afraid, and they said, gods have come into the camp. And they also said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, in order not to become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight." And so the Philistines fought. Israel was defeated and fled, everyone to his home. There was a great slaughter, and the Ark of God was captured. And then we'll return to this element in a moment. The 2 sons of Eli, Hophni and Pinchas, died. Okay. The reason for the initial defeat, according to the biblical writer, is telegraphed here in this very last verse, verse 11. The sins of the sons of Eli, which had been recounted in 1 Samuel 2, a section that we didn't read here this afternoon. But the sins of these two priests becomes a problem for all Israel when Israel takes no time to seek the cause of the initial defeat, but rather simply reaches for the ark as a solution in and of itself. The important intertext here is found in the response of Joshua to the defeat of the Israelite army at Ai after Achan had taken booty for himself in violation of Mosaic law. We won't look at all of this, but I'm now referring to the fourth text in the handout from Joshua 7:6, where after a similar defeat, we see Joshua also asks the question of his God, why has this defeat come upon us? But then, having asked the question, Joshua then goes to extraordinary end to make inquiry as to who the guilty parties are among the Israelites that would have occasioned this defeat. The sin of Achan is discovered, taken care of, and then the Israelites can go forth in battle successfully. That's precisely what doesn't take place here in the text from 1 Samuel. No inquiry is made. The individuals on the field evidently feel no inquiry is necessary. Rather, simply pick up the ark and go off to battle. So as I said, it's striking that this, what we see in the book of Joshua, is exactly what the Israelites do not do in Samuel. Instead, they go to the shrine, remove the ark, and believe that its sacramental agency will be sufficient to bring them victory. That's important to add here. It's not the fact that the ark and God are not conjoined. They are, as we'll see as the narrative of Samuel unfolds, but they're not conjoined in such a way that Israel can use the benefits of the divine presence willy-nilly to her advantage. We can contrast this aberrant understanding of the power of the ark with that of David in 2 Samuel 15. Here is a man who possesses a divine promise regarding the eternal character of his kingdom, 2 Samuel 7, one of the most important texts in the entire Old Testament. But even with this promissory note in hand, when he's driven from the city of Jerusalem by his upstart son Absalom, David refuses to take the ark as a guarantee of his safe return. Here clearly in David's person is a theology of the ark that is reflective of the dignity of the ark and the God who dwells upon it. Beginning in verse 24, Abiathar came up and Zadok also with all the Levites carrying the ark of the covenant of God. They presumably think bringing it out is going to be a good luck charm for David, as the warriors thought in 1 Samuel. They set the ark down until the people had all passed out of the city. And then the king said to Zadok, carry the ark back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and let me both see both it and the place where it dwells. But if God should say, I take no pleasure in you, here I am, let him do to me what seems good to him. In this text, David realizes the depth of his sin that Nathan had rebuked him for several chapters earlier. And though David has no doubts about the power of the ark, he's spiritually mature enough to realize it will provide no advantage in his current penitential state. The freedom of God, in David's mind, is honored precisely in respect to this object to which God has tied his being. That's a very important point, I think, to bear in mind here, and let me repeat it again. The freedom of God in this text is honored precisely in respect to the object to which God has tied his being. There are many scholars, I think, that find the deeply sacramental, we could even say Catholic sense of the ark in the priestly narrative to be offensive, precisely because of the worries many Protestants have about Catholic sacramentality, that the freedom of God somehow is compromised by bringing it into such close association with a material item and priestly servants of that item. But I think as we can see here in 2 Samuel 15, ironically, that close association of God with object is a guarantor of God's freedom, not something that puts it in danger. It is for this reason that the Ark narrative comes to a preliminary conclusion in 1 Samuel 6 with the story of the Ark's return to Israel and the slaying of those in Beit Shemesh who greet its arrival improperly. Here we have to turn to number 6 in your handout. There, we won't read the whole thing, but the key verse here is verse 20. The people from Beit Shemesh cry out when they see the danger that the Ark presents for the city upon its return. They say, here virtually quoting Psalm 24 or Psalm 15, "Who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God?" Here we can see where my talk is driving, the holiness of God as something that should strike fear in those who would draw near to this God. God is not to be used, in other words, like a rabbit's foot to guarantee one's success, as we saw at the beginning of 1 Samuel 4. Rather, every approach to the ark is to be understood as potentially dangerous, and great personal introspection should be used before approaching it, and certainly before employing it for any liturgical or military purpose. So the people cry out, "Who is able to stand before the Lord?" And the implied answer is obvious. No mortal should presume himself safe when standing before the God of Israel. The men of Beit Shemesh do the rational thing. They forward this dangerous cargo to the inhabitants of another city, Kiriat Yearim. And here I'm reminded, again, this I think is hard for moderns, perhaps even Catholics, to appreciate, but it might be useful just to remember the remarks of the young Martin Luther when he was called to the altar to participate in his first Mass. He remarked, and he said this several times over the course of his writing, so it was clearly something that deeply struck him and remained with him. He said he would have never approached the altar to offer the sacrifice of the Mass if it hadn't been for the social pressure of all the other priests around him. The fear of holding God was an awe-inspiring moment to his person. And I think that's precisely the logic of these lines here, too. Who is able to stand the fear of the holiness of God and our unworthiness of being in his presence is what's inscribed so deeply, I think, in these chapters. So this brings me to the main subject of my talk today, the story of Nadav and Avihu in the book of Leviticus. And let's begin with the story itself. Text number 8. It concludes here with the blessing of Aaron and Moses, verses 22 and 23. Then the moment we spoke of, verse 24, fire coming out and consuming the burnt offering, the people seeing this spectacular theophany, shouting aloud in praise and falling on their faces. And then the tragic episode of Leviticus 10, where two of Aaron's sons, taking censer in hand, offer alien fire, and then for a reward for their efforts, are consumed by the fire that had made itself present on the altar. The narrative concludes with Moses saying to Aaron, this is what the Lord meant when he said, "Those who are near me," krovai in Hebrew, "I will show myself holy before all the people. I will be glorified." And Aaron was silent. The story about Nadav and Avihu's cultic error has puzzled interpreters for centuries, going all the way back to Philo of Alexandria. And over two millennia, no consensus among interpreters, whether Jewish or Christian, has emerged as to what was done wrong, also pre-modern or modern. All interpreters are, I think, on the same plane at finding themselves flummoxed by the problems this text presents us. I'm going to look at simply a representative sampling of four different medieval Jewish interpreters, but you could find their thinking represented in a handful of modern commentaries as well. Let's begin with Gersonides. He says, "What made the fire they took alien was that it was not taken from the right place on the outer altar, but came from elsewhere, Perhaps they had a pocket lighter. I don't know. But they took the fire from elsewhere. That's why it was called alien fire. It was not altar fire. Avarbanel says this: the problem was that though the high priest may offer incense whenever he wishes, ordinary priests only do so when chosen for it by lot, and no priest does so twice in his lifetime. On this inaugural day of all days, the high priest was supposed to perform each part of the ritual, especially the incense ritual, which was the most spiritual. The incense altar was directly in front of the Ark of the Covenant, and it was frequently spoken of in the book of Leviticus in such a way as though the parochet, the veil, that divided the holy from the holies, holy of holies, wasn't there. Perhaps this led to the odd geography found in the Epistle to the Hebrews, which actually places this altar on the other side of the parochet, in clear distinction from what seems to be the simple sense of the book of Exodus, but that's a different problem altogether. What's important, though, is its prime location. And Abarbanel's remark that the incense ritual was the most spiritual. So here we can see with Abarbanel a very different sense of the of what made this fire problematic. It wasn't the quality of the fire itself, but who was offering it. Sephorno. Well, Nadav and Avihu understood from Exodus 29, verse 38, through the beginning of chapter 30, these are the laws for the introductory sacrifices that were to be offered at the end of Leviticus 9. They understood that incense was to be offered every day. They're conjoined there, so they must have thought they were to be conjoined here. And since the Shekhinah, this is the Hebrew term for God's tabernacling presence, had appeared now, they assumed that they were supposed to offer the incense now too. And then finally, Chizkuni, he focuses on the biblical verse, they laid incense on the fire, and remarks, all incense offerings involve fire. It was in fact the incense itself, not the fire, that was alien, meaning it was a private rather than public. Okay, four very different understanding of what has gone wrong in this incident, and there's no way to arrive at any kind of consensus among them. And again, like I say, if I had picked modern commentaries on Leviticus 10, we would find the same thing, and we would find perhaps not surprisingly modern commentaries introducing an element that pre-moderns wouldn't, and that would be simply the political, that what we have at stake here is a dispute between religious families. And all that's important is that Nadav and Avihu are incinerated as a polemical remark about the pedigree of a certain religious order. You probably have heard jokes that Dominicans say about the Jesuits. I'm sure they're returned, and you would understand polemics of this nature. In any event, that's an additional modern answer. Okay. Modern scholars, as I said, have joined this list of esteemed interpreters and have replicated nearly every one of these theories without reaching any sort of consensus. Now we're coming to the point. On this score, I'm reminded of what Robert Jensen, a Lutheran theologian of considerable repute, once said about the atonement. He wrote in his Systematic Theology that if after 2,000 years of theological reflection, the Christian tradition can agree on no single theoretical explanation as to what the mechanism of atonement was, then perhaps that very point should be the starting point for theological reflection. In fact, one biblical scholar, going back to Leviticus 10, Ed Greenstein, has posed that very question to the exegesis of Leviticus 10. The fact that no consensus is possible, it becomes the starting point for Greenstein's investigation of this text. And I think of all modern readers of this text, he provides the best window into what's going on here. Now, unfortunately, I always require this essay by Greenstein for my students who take my course on the tabernacle at Notre Dame. I should confess that almost everybody hates this article because Greenstein employs Derridean deconstructive vocabulary to make his point. And I can see why students don't like this. I'm not a Derridean, and I'm not going to advocate Ed Greenstein's the Derridean reading of Leviticus 10, but I think we should perhaps honor the principle of St. Augustine about grounding why he would read pagan writers in the motif of despoiling the Egyptians of their wealth. There are some things actually that deconstructive theory can get right. We don't have to subscribe, on the other hand, to all the metaphysics that drive their literary interests. And that's how I want to proceed here. In fact, if you take a look at the text number 13 on the handout, it's going to be a section of Greenstein, and part of Greenstein, this is ironical, is under erasure, if you know that term. In other words, I'm altering his text to bring it in accord with my own theology and not his. But my point is this, I don't have to do much. In other words, I think Ed's nearly there, and I don't do this to besmirch his name. Actually, Ed is a deeply theological reader of Scripture, and I do think that Derrida allows him to see more than many have, but I think also subscribing to Derridean metaphysics takes him down a rabbit hole I think we don't wish to go. But with that in mind, let's proceed here. What I really want to do is add just a few tweaks to his vocabulary so that we can arrive at a reading that I think would fit nicely into the apophatic, cataphatic dimension of the thought of St. Denis. So where Derrida is going to see aporia and lack of meaning, St. Denis would see apophasis and lack of total knowledge about the character of God. In order to make my point effectively, we'll need to step back for just a moment, though, and take a look at the larger context of Leviticus 10. So we're not going to be able to understand Greenstein yet. We need to look at this last page. In a lot of ways, it's really hard to, I think, appreciate. This makes this lecture very difficult. If I was to do this lecture properly, I would have to go on until about 8 o'clock, because we would want to work through all of the tabernacle narrative, Exodus 25 to 40, and the Levitical laws for sacrifice in Leviticus 1 to 7, to get a sense of the world that's being constructed here by these chapters, because it's against the grain of all of that that we have to understand Leviticus 10. Now, I don't think that Thomas Joseph would be happy if I went on to 8. I'm sure most people would leave probably by a quarter after 3, so I'm not going to do that. But what I'm going to try to do simply on this last page is give you a little sense of what I might do if I had that much time. The first thing to be observed, something noted by rabbinic, medieval, and modern interpreters, is the parallelism between the creation of the world in Genesis 1 and the building of the tabernacle in Exodus 25 through Leviticus 9. Well, thank you very much. Wow, we got real gentlemen here. It's incredible. Most places I go, you just throw it on the ground. Okay. As W.H. Schmidt put the matter, Moses concludes the building of the cult objects similar to the way God concluded the building of the world. End of quote. We see one element in this link to creation in Leviticus 8 in this usage of a sevenfold refrain of approbation about all of Moses' compliance with the fulfillment of the law, which I've marked here in bold and numbered them for you, so that just as God concludes seven acts of creation in chapter 1 with a statement of approbation that God saw X, that it was good, so here in Leviticus 8, the text concludes seven times with Moses' completion of the ritual demands with the formula of approbation that he's done exactly as God had commanded him, commands that we would have read in Exodus 29. Secondly, is the manner in which this successful building project succeeds in conjuring the presence of God. Moses opens the rites of the eighth day, which begins in Leviticus 9. Leviticus 8 is all about the consecration of the priesthood, where we have this sevenfold repetition that Moses has done everything as God has commanded him, which prepares us for the events of the eighth day in Leviticus 9, in which God will make his appearance. Moses opens these rites of the eighth day with the warning to the priests that they must do exactly as God has commanded. We see this in verses 6 and 7. alluding back to the fulfillment of those commands in chapter 8. Aaron complies with complete obedience and succeeds then in attracting the divine presence to the sacrificial altar. We've already looked at this verse a couple times. Fire came out from the presence of the Lord. It's at the bottom of the page there in small caps, and consumed the burnt offering. In allowing the tabernacle then to be built and the cult to begin, God has invited Israel to participate in his own divine life. But along with this gracious condescension is a terrible risk. By allowing Israel's liturgical actions to attain near theurgic capabilities, a threat to the freedom of God lurks in the background. Has the priesthood gained the upper hand over the being of God? To regain what is at risk of being lost, the Bible includes this tragic tale of Nadav and Avihu to reawaken in the reader a sense of God's utter transcendence and holiness. And with this in mind, perhaps we can turn the page back and read Greenstein and appreciate, I think, the profundities that his analysis allows us to discover. The story of Nadav and Avihu as narrative intrudes into the exposition of cultic law that precedes and follows it. Cultic law that goes back to Exodus 25 and cultic law that's going to follow through the middle of the book of Numbers. It may strike the reader as disrupting the text as violently as the flash of fire annihilated the young priests. As the narrative genre of the episode disturbs the legal landscape by its otherness, so does its representation of a possibly opaque and nonverbal suprarational, not irrational, suprarational God upset the orderliness of the cultic system. Notwithstanding the cultic regulations, God has not in fact explained everything. In other words, I think that's precisely the danger of what lurks from Exodus 25 to Leviticus 9, is that the reader, the priest, may have felt that by virtue of everything that's been explained, that God has revealed everything about himself, at least with respect to how his presence may be conjured on the altar. But, Greenstein continues, that certainly is not the case. The system contains terrible dark secrets the Lord may strike without warning. In our reading, the Lord interrupts the orderliness to show that he is greater than the cultic order. A God worthy of name cannot be wholly contained by rules any more than an infinite God can be contained by names, by language. The priest can only control what the priest does. He cannot control God. Behind the orderly veneer of priestly ritual, behind the parochet, that's the inner veil, that screens off the Lord's quasi-condensed presence from the human observer, is the unscrutable other. The Lord can hardly be better comprehended than the motives of Nadav and Avihu and the question of whether they had done anything amiss. Okay, end of quote. To put the matter, as I would rather put it, in more Dionysian terms, the terms of St. Denis, in the commands that God has given Moses, we witness what I would call the cataphatic side of revelation. God has graciously bequeathed to us enough information about himself and the world he has created so that we can attract his physical presence to a structure built by human hands and tend to his daily needs. Medieval Jewish exegesis and the rabbis themselves are quite taken by what we might want to say the participatory dynamic of the tabernacle narrative, of how it invites human beings to participate in the creative acts of God. I think capturing the sense of the simple sense of Exodus quite well, the medievals, again, basing themselves on the rabbis, argue that when the tabernacle is erected in Exodus 40, creation has come to its close. Creation hasn't been finished until Exodus 40. Creation is not simply a divine act, but an act that invites Israel into its telos, its finish. But this cataphatic dimension, I would want to suggest, always requires, at least in the Christian imagination, an apophatic corrective. Lest we become inebriated by the power God has conferred upon us and presume that the theurgic dimension has given us a handle on God's very being, the radical otherness of God's majestic glory breaks out and establishes his utter transcendence over any work or deed of human hands. And this is the reason I would want to suggest we can never know precisely what Nadav and Avihu did that was wrong. Because if we could discover that, our propensity to hubris would not be lessened, but rather abetted. We would simply learn our lesson and then presume under the presumption that we've got everything figured out. But the fact that we can't figure it out indicates and inscribes within us that there's something here that's bigger than any set of laws is ever going to able to contain, and approaching God will always be dangerous. Again, something like the lesson from 1 Samuel. Who can stand before the Lord our God? Psalm 24, Psalm 15. Biblical law loves this dialectic. The law for words for sacrifice in Hebrew, lahakriv, actually means to bring near. And a sacrifice is a korban, a something brought near. So you're required to bring things near, but being near is dangerous. That's, I think, what Leviticus 10 here is all about. The biblical author does not want us so much to learn from their example as to develop a sense of wariness whenever we approach the altar of God. We want to turn back, actually, to text, let's see here, on the very last page. Here we have a difference between modern and ancient sensibilities. I think Luther's sensibility of fear of approaching the altar to hold the very body of God is something that's lost on many moderns, even those who have a theoretical notion of high sacramental presence. But that kind of physical fear and reverence is something that I think is difficult. Mary Douglas has written very nicely on this among moderns. Also, what's striking in verse 7 of chapter 9 is something that ancients see that moderns don't see, and that's the significance of verse 7 and the fact that Moses has to command Aaron to come forward to the altar. I have it underlined. It's karav in Hebrew, draw near. Why does he do that? Well, the medievals have a good answer for that. Aaron's scared. He's shaking in his shoes. He doesn't want to draw near. He needs to be commanded to draw near to do this. In this sense, the story of Nadav and Avihu and that of the Ark and the books of Samuel are of a piece. The power of the Ark is not to be underestimated, but neither is the Ark to become an object fully under human control. Like the residents of Beit Shemesh, we too should cry out when beholding the Ark or the altar, who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? There is good reason, then, why interpreters have found it difficult to locate the precise character of the error of Nadav and Avihu. Our text, which hitherto had been so deeply invested in the cataphatic process of revelation, recoils in worry that the reader who's mastered the many details of Levitical law may believe that he's acquired the formula for conjuring the divine presence. God, it would appear, has become a domesticated presence. However, in the flash of an eye, as the sons of Aaron brashly approach the altar, any notion of human control over the God of Israel goes up in smoke. Through those near to me, God declares, I show myself holy. A verse that the noted Jewish medieval interpreter Abarvanel glossed, quote, do not be surprised that those who serve God, do not be surprised that those who serve God most closely are in the most danger. Those who fight on the front lines are the most likely to die. Thank you.